We'll begin here this morning. Good morning and welcome, and I'm sure darn near everybody's read the minutes, but somebody must be willing to make a motion to approve the minutes of the previous meeting.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian moved to approve the meetings, the minutes of the previous meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. I've got a bill up here. We're going to look at it, number one, and so I'm going to go up front, and Vice Chair Becker Finn will take over. And she's going to be as kind as she can be to the first bill author.
I don't know. Whatever you got.
All right, Chair Purcell, if you would like to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 758 moved to put that in front of us, and it's to be referred to the floor, as I understand the language.
Yep, so we have before us House File 758. Chair Purcell, I understand you have a brief author's amendment. Can you explain your amendment, please?
I do, Madam Chair and members. Oral amendment on line 1.19, after the word departments, I would like to insert two words, wholly or partially.
All right, so members, the motion is to amend House File 758 on line 1.19 after the word departments, add wholly or partially. And I believe, Mr. Chair Purcell, that this is to in line with the Senate version of the bill, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
All right, any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. The amendment passes. Chair Purcell, I think in the interest of time and respect for any people that might have traveled down here, we'll let you present your bill and get to any testifiers before we have any questions. I'm not sure if you have any testifiers, given the distance of the Mississippi headwaters to our committee, but go ahead with a presentation of your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just briefly on this bill, a little bit of history. Some know it well and others may not. The Mississippi Headwaters Board is an 8-county joint powers board that was established in 1980, signing a joint powers agreement, and the purpose of this was to maintain local and state control, as it were, over the Wild and Federal Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. So this bill is brought before us today with just a couple of, as you can read, a couple of language changes, just to bring it as up to date as we can. And I just want to, I did call back to my township, the Frome Town Board I was on, because our township did take over jurisdiction of Lakeshore several years ago. And I wanted to find out that if we were all good with that, and I thought we were. And my understanding, in fact, the way it's been given to me from the legal folks, is that the most restrictive regulations apply. So if a township is more restrictive than a county, for instance, then the township applies. And that's the way our township has implemented this. So I just wanted that to, excuse me, to be out there, and any questions, and I understand there's one there's a gentleman that came up that wanted to testify, that, so I know there's one testifier anyway.
All right, Chair Purcell, please proceed with your testifiers. Is there...
I don't remember the fellow's
okay.
name.
If there's anyone in the audience that would like to testify, now would be the time to come forward.
No.
This is you're wanting to be on which bill? 200. I'm sorry.
Regarding House File 758.
All right.
If there are any testifiers, anyone in the audience who'd like to testify, please come forward. Seeing none, Chair Purcell, and any final comments on your bill as amended?
Any questions, yeah.
Representative Lulick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see one of the things that in the first page there, line 1.20, this excludes statutory and home rule charter cities, and I just wanted to mention that I agree with that because that's a whole other situation, and at least in my area, we've got a whole string of very small villages, so to speak, along the river, and while I suspect some of them may or may not have came down to testify, had this going to apply to absolutely the cities are a separate entity there. So I appreciate, and hopefully we won't lose that language in this bill as it goes forward, because I know that's a little bit of a concern with the small cities along the river. And like it or not, their waterfronts developed. I appreciate this. Aiken County has been involved in this since the day one, and I don't see any funding in here. Is that you got, Mr. Chair? You got a bill coming on that one?
I don't have a fiscal note, so not Madam Chair. I don't. I'm not going to speak to that. Let me say that.
Madam Chair, I'm referring to the counties and the local units of government fund this thing, a bunch of it on their back,
mm-hmm.
but there is typically an annual funding stream. It does come from the state that supports some of that infrastructure for that Headwaters Board, and if it doesn't come, then it just gets forced onto the local property taxes. So we'll have to talk on that later.
Representative Luke, I suspect that'll come before us maybe on the Finance Committee. So thank you for your comments. Any other comments, questions from members? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize for having to step out, but when I was reading the bill, and the one thing that kind of disturbs me, Representative, is it seems like you're just over-serping all local authority here. And you know, it talks a little bit about some of the stuff, but really when you get down to the crux of the bill, it looks to me like at the end of the day that the Mississippi Headwaters Board is going to have complete authority over all the local governments. Is that the way this reads?
Madam Chair and Representative Green, absolutely not. And you weren't in here when I talked about the townships. The Broome Township in Beltrami County, we have jurisdiction on Lakeshore. And the most restrictive Lakeshore regulations apply. That's the way this is set up. The most restrictive.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. But then, so really, that is the case then, because if the Mississippi Headwaters Board then comes in and says you're not doing what we want, you're not restrictive enough, then they all of a sudden grab the authority from the township.
No,
is that right?
That's not my understanding of being on the town board. No, sir.
Okay.
Any other questions from members? Final comments, Chair Purcell?
Appreciate support for the bill. Thank you.
Chair Purcell renews his motion to move House File 758 as amended back to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
All right. The bill moves as amended, and we'll play musical chairs here as the chair gets
Thanks,
back.
Madam Chair and members.
Representative Tabke, if you want to come forward on House File 680 and get ready while we're moving chairs here. guess I'm getting the go-ahead from the chair to go forward. So, Representative Tabke, if you want to get started here.
I have treats.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. First time.
First time.
I vote aye.
All right. All others in favor?
Representative Tabke, I'll remind you, it is your first time. You don't have the gavel. Representative Tabke, I will move House File 680 to be placed on the general register. So, members, we have before us House File 680. And Representative Tabke, I understand you have an author's amendment labeled DE1. I will also move your amendment, DE1, to put the bill in the form that you would like. Does everyone agree have the amendment in front of them? So those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Tabke, please present your bill as amended to our committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee. I appreciate everyone's time. I feel like I'm super loud here, so I'll back off a little bit. As I said, my name is Brad Tabke, and we have a bill in front of us today to allow hunters to use leashed dogs in order to track game after they have shot, to track blood tracks and to track the deer. I will first off say that I am not a hunter, so we have awesome experts here to help out with those pieces, but this is a bill that was brought to me by a constituent in Shakopee that would like this to move forward, and he is here with us today and braved the weather to get here, and so he'll be talking, but this bill will allow hunters to use leashed dogs, 30-foot leashes, in order to track big game after they've been shot and to find them. This does not change anything about private property rights. This keeps everything the same, and private property does not change anything. If a dog is chasing big game unleashed, this does not change anything like that. Hunter has, or anyone has, a right to shoot a dog that is chasing big game, and that keeps that all of the same. And the first bill language that was introduced was language from House Research, and then we talked heavily with the DNR, and the language that you have today is almost identical to the language the DNR has given us, and they are here today to answer any questions on that as well. The one thing that is different between the language the DNR gave us and what you have in front of you today is there are 38 states in the United States that allow leash tracking of big game, and some of them allow it as you can be armed while you're doing that. Some of them allow it to only be unarmed as they're tracking big game. And so we have brought you the bill today in the form that is allowing you to be armed while you are tracking big game, but we are prepared with the amendment if that's a discussion that people want to have here today, and I am comfortable with going whichever way folks would like to go with that. So this is a bill also that is really important to folks that are colorblind, who especially are red-green colorblind, who my constituent happens to be, and because you cannot track blood trails as easily if you are colorblind. So this will allow blood trail tracking to be done with dogs. And so there's a lot of different components to this, and we'll bring up Steve. Do you want to go first? All right, so Steve Stoff will come up. And Madam Chair, whenever you are ready.
Yep, and at the testifier, if you could introduce yourself for the committee.
All right, my name is Steve Stoff. I'm a constituent in 55A and here to testify on behalf of HF 680.
Yep, please go ahead with your testimony.
So I grew up hunting my entire life, and one of the principles my father instilled in me was that you exhaust every resource to your ability to recover game that you shoot. And currently in Minnesota, that's not the case with the ability to use a dog to do that. And we are one of the few states left to allow that. And I think this bill is written really well to appease the DNR, to appease the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. And as the president of the Minnesota Hunting Club, it has full support of that group, which is a 23,000 member group as well. I am colorblind. I do have issues trailing deer if I shoot one before snow falls, and there are ways to do that without a dog. But again, I'm a huge proponent of exhausting every possible resource to recover a wounded big game animal, and that's why I'm here today.
All right. Thank you. Representative Tabke, do you have any other testifiers?
I'm not sure if that – do you – we also have folks from United Blood Tracking. They came here from Wisconsin, and I don't – do you have anything you'd like to add right now or just wait if any questions come up?
We'd like to wait if there's any questions.
Okay. So if for the record, there are some other folks here from a blood tracking organization, and they're available if members do have any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? All right. Looks like having none. Members, if you have questions, looks like Representative Heitzman has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounded like there may be two different paths for the bill, and one would be with the potential of carrying a firearm, and one would be without. I was wondering what the testifier's perspective was.
My perspective is to be with. Carrying with, and that's really for the to dispatch an animal that's suffering. No different than if you were tracking a wounded deer or a bear without a dog and you were sight tracking it, you would want to dispatch that animal as quickly and as cleanly as possible. No different than if a highway patrolman finds a wounded deer at the side of the road or that's called in, that animal is dispatched quickly and cleanly to eliminate the suffering. So I back or support being able to carry your weapon with you.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was assuming that was the case, but just wanted a clarification. Thank you.
Representative Lisligard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do support this bill wholeheartedly, being a hunter myself and not being the best shot. Any assistance that I could have would be wonderful. Thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just reading this, and in the DE, which I apologize for not having the DE till today. I should have looked at it. But in subdivision 4, it talks about if a deer or bear is located or and is alive, any dog handler and dog must leave the immediate area. But the whole idea is to track a wounded animal. So I'm assuming this doesn't mean that if the animal's wounded and alive, you have to leave it. Is that correct?
Representative Tabke.
Yes, that is correct, and the intent for that is if you, as I understand it, and we can have DNR add any context if we need to here, but the intent with that is if we found a different animal, and so if you are using a dog and you find a different animal, and the reason for this is to mitigate the possibility of which we don't think would happen. On a regular basis whatsoever, but for running deer and running bear and things like that. So this puts a clear delineation between those things.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I don't read it that way because we're talking about a wounded deer, and on line 4.1 it says, if the deer or bear is located. I think that this is going to open up a can of worms when it comes to enforcement. Mm-hmm. I wish that, quite frankly, it wasn't there because it says the dog handler and the dog must leave the area immediately. This language really needs to be cleaned up to make sure that the intent of the bill is actually carried forward. This, Madam Chair, this is not well written from my perspective.
I wonder if,
and then I would ask, what is the definition of immediate area?
Representative Tabke?
Yeah, I would request someone from DNR. I'm not sure who exactly is here, but I've been told that DNR is available.
Yeah, Colonel Smith from the DNR, I believe, is here. If you can come forward.
To help us with that. Thank you, sir.
Colonel, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, first we'd like to thank Representative for working with us on this language. So the language that you do see before us is language that we did develop with at DNR for the most part and work with the author on. So to answer a couple questions, so to answer Representative Fabian's question, when it talks about, it doesn't say they have to leave immediately on line 4.1. It says they have to leave the immediate area. And so what we've done, what we did at DNR is we looked at a number of different states that have language about dogs and tracking deer, and we try to take the best from all and try to make something that's much very workable. And so the intent of having the dog and the handler leave the immediate area, it doesn't mean they have to leave immediately, is so that there are times when an animal is shot and the wound is somewhat superficial or minor, and they're going to live. And we've seen that happen. If you're a hunter, you've seen deer that have gotten shot or they get hit by a car and they live. And so, you know, it might be a somewhat minor wound. And so, but the intent here is that we don't continue to chase an animal that may otherwise be able to recover. So the deer is located or the bear is located, the dog leaves the area, and then the hunter has the opportunity to go in and finish the take if that's possible.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Smith. It just doesn't read well to me. It just doesn't. If I were to ask staff, and I don't mean to put Ms. Taylor on the spot here, but what is the legal definition for immediate area?
Ms. Taylor.
Rodman, I just think that this is going to cause problems.
Mr. Chair, members, immediate area is not defined. I think you just have to use the common interpretation of that so that we wouldn't have, you know, like a square footage or anything like that. So,
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and then the other question I have is that with regards to a wounded deer, it's 20 yards away, it's 75 yards away. How is any deer hunter to determine that it's not a fatal wound, it's a flesh wound or whatever? I don't see how we determine that. And who is going to determine that?
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Representative Fabian. So the dog and the handler have to leave. The hunter can still stay there, and the hunter can approach that deer, walk right up to it. We're just asking that the dog leave that immediate area so that the hunter then can finish the take. Immediate area is not defined. We don't define every single term in statute. We don't define what blaze orange is, you know. So, 20 yards in one part of the state is, you know, different than 20 yards in another part of the state.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What if the handler is the hunter?
Colonel Smith.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, then I guess the handler could take the dog, tie it to a tree out of the immediate area, then walk back and finish the take.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
I can see an amendment coming at some point on this. So thank you, Madam Chair. Then I have one other question on 3.27 and 3.28. The dog's on a leash. I don't understand why the dog's owner information, including the owner's name and telephone number, must be on the dog while the dog is used to locate a wounded deer or bear under this section.
Colonel Smith?
To the testifiers.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, that's because in case the dog gets off the leash and runs. And that's standard language if you look across states, that the dog is identified, has the owner's name and phone number on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Fabian and Colonel Smith, hopefully we're using good, solid leashes. That's not a non-issue, but I appreciate, you know, wanting to make sure. Any other questions? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm going to go back to that language on 4.1. So let's walk through this again. If the deer or bear is located and is alive, well, have you ever heard of the circumstance where you're tracking something without a dog and you locate it and you see it and you're not able to dispatch it because while it's wounded, it's still very mobile and up and away it goes again? So doesn't this prolong the suffering if in the meantime I think I see the deer? In a way, in the hunter and the dog turn around, go the other way in the hopes of coming back, that that animal may still be bedded there. I mean, that just defies the things that my dad taught me about how it works when you do have an animal that's wounded and their behavior. And it just, the first part of it here, if it's located and alive, stop. And particularly if your situation where it's a hunter and the dog or a unit, they're going to turn around and go the other way, and then they're going to come back. I can just tell you, frankly, that ain't going to work. I mean, you're going to have a situation where hunter's going to come back, and we're going to start all over again because the deer may or bear may have moved.
Colonel Smith, Representative Tabaki, any response?
Nope, not. It was a very clear observation. I understand. I don't know if any of our testifiers would like to. All right. Madam Chair, is it all right if Mr. Stoff comes down?
Yes. Mr. Stoff, if you want to come up and help answer that question.
I think it's tough to write into legislative language common sense laws about hunting if you know what type of shot you've made on a deer. You know if it's a good shot, you know if it's a bad shot, your initial blood, your initial tracking will tell you those things. If, for instance, you make a liver shot, that blood looks differently than a double lung shot in the color of blood. You're also not taking into effect that you are going to be sight tracking as well, and if you have optics or binoculars, you can look. Is the deer's head up? Does it look active? Does it look mobile? If you're going to give your best effort to recover that deer, you're not going to pursue any further. You're going to back out 2, 3, 4 hours, 8 hours to let that deer perish so you do not continue the suffering and push that deer forward. So you have to go back to the ethics of hunting and tracking to begin with. You know, the goal is if you need to bring in a dog to track your wounded deer, you know you didn't make a good shot. You're not going to immediately jump out of your stand, call a tracker to come help you and do that immediately. You're going to give that deer time to expire, to bed down, and to wait before you call our friends at the UBC or a licensed tracker.
I think Representative Bow had the next question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too had written some notes to myself about Section 4.1, and I assume that if the deer or bear is located, that you would dispatch it, and that's kind of what we have talked about as well. And I was going to maybe suggest a friendly amendment of, if a different deer or bear is located and is alive, the dog handler and the dog should leave the immediate area. To clarify, a deer or bear that was shot and you're following it versus a totally separate one that you happen upon in the search.
Representative Tapke, any response?
I would like to ask the DNR what they think of that type of language, if that makes it more confusing, or if that from a... You guys can both sit up here if you'd like.
I can have lots of chairs. Colonel Smith.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair Representative, if the dog finds a different deer or bear, that sucker's gone. It's going to run away. If a dog and a person's coming, they're not going to bed down. So I think, the testifier did a good job of explaining when we talk about ethics and tracking. So if you want to make amendments, make amendments, but I think we're there.
Members, I think it is a valid discussion to have, and, you know, we certainly want to make sure that the bill is in the form that makes the most sense, that's going to work for deer hunters and do what you want the bill to do. So I wonder, Representative Tabke, if I think at this point it might make sense regarding, you know, it sounds like an amendment might be in order, Representative Tabke, and might make sense to lay this on the table so we can do some of that work and make sure that we have the language right going forward. Representative Tabke, if you want to speak to that.
I am comfortable with the language as it is. If the DNR is comfortable with the language, if you would like to do that, I'm more than happy to continue to work with everyone to get that done.
Representative Tabke, I recognize too that you told us from the outset you're not a hunter, and I know you want to do the right thing, mm-hmm. By way of us who are those of us who are deer hunters. So, and Representative Fabian, maybe if you want to speak to that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I too am a hunter, and
I just, the motion, I believe, is to go to the general register, and that kind of creates some problems from my perspective. I don't know that the House floor is a useful place to have a conversation like this and a debate on an amendment to something like this. I just think that we should do our work to get things so that when they do get to the floor, they're ready for prime time. And I would strongly encourage you to take the chair's advice.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tapke, we have two other bills on the agenda. If it was laid on the table, you could work with staff and get language that would be acceptable. We could bring it back up at the end of the meeting.
All right. So I will withdraw the motion to refer to the general register, and then the motion would be to lay House File 680 as amended on the table. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. So we will lay House File 680 as amended on the table, and hopefully we can come back to it soon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Up is House File 721, Representative Lee, insecticide use in wildlife management area prohibited. To your bill, we'll bring that bill in front of us, and please tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 21 ensures that Minnesota's WMAs, or wildlife managed area, remain a safe haven for bees and other wildlife. Bees and other pollinators need clean food, a safe place to build their homes, and to survive. Sadly, with the widespread and intensive use of bee toxic neonicotinoids, or neonics, across the state, and fewer native flowers, that's incredibly hard to find. Minnesota WMAs and other natural areas remain and some of the few places where bees and pollinators can actually find true refuge, and the state should ensure that they stay that way. This bill protects the fundamental mission of Minnesota's WMAs. Minnesota WMAs were created to protect wildlife for the benefit of all Minnesotans, but continued losses of bees and other pollinators threaten the collapse of plant and bird populations and the state's environment at large. Safeguarding these keystone species from toxic pesticides ensures Minnesota WMAs remain a vital, healthy home for all wildlife. And I do have some testifiers here, too.
Please bring your testifiers forward. And I want to back up, excuse me, just a little bit here, I move House File 721. Be placed on the general register. That's the motion. So that's what we're hearing here today. So please proceed.
My name is Margaret Munson. I live in St. Paul. I'm a beekeeper and an entomologist. So while I'm sure you all know, honeybees are critically important to pollinating a lot of our food crops, are you aware that Minnesota has over 470 species of native bees? The ones most easily recognized are the 23 species of bumblebees. And these native bees are actually, in many cases, more efficient in pollinating certain crops. For example, tomatoes, peppers. But all these native bees are critical to pollinating lots of foods that we also eat, like tomato, squash, blueberries, cranberries. They are critically important for those crops to be successful. So except for the very large and social bumblebees that make a big nest underground with a few hundred members, these native bees are solitary, and they are evolved right along with our native plants. So what do I mean by solitary native bees? They're very small to medium-sized bees, sometimes brightly colored green or blue, and they do not create these large nests. The female starts all by herself, creating hidden places. Most of them nest underground, so they create some tunnels underground, where they provide the pollen that they gather for their young. Some of them nest above ground, also in hidden places like plant stems. And what they do is they gather pollen, bring it back to this nest that they've created, deposit the pollen and lay an egg. They go back outside, and they do this all day long, gathering pollen, bringing it to their nest site, laying an egg. And eventually the female then doesn't have any more eggs, and she dies. These immature native bees remain underground all the rest of the season, many of them all winter, and you don't see them until next spring when the adults emerge. So they finish all this development underground, eating pollen that is the protein they need to survive. The females that do these different species, some of them only live a couple of weeks, so they really have a lot to get done in a short period of time. As these bees gather this nourishment they need to feed their young, they're moving between flowers of the same species, and so then they're actually pollinating these plants. There are other insects that pollinate. Wasps, flies, moths, beetles, they also pollinate too, and they're a part of the ecosystem. But a lot of those are actually predators, they're not providing pollen for their young. They're eating other insects in the environment. As well as doing that, these native bees are responsible for keeping our woodlands, our wetlands, our prairies, our deserts pollinated. Honeybees don't do that. So if you appreciate any of the wild places, you have to give credit to the native bees. In the past several years, a huge amount of research has been showing that chemicals are affecting bee health. In addition to our beekeepers losing sometimes 50% or more of their bees, native bees are also suffering. Just in 2016, the first bumblebee was put on the federal list for endangerment, the rusty patch bumblebee. It used to be a really common bee. You could find it much of the eastern United States and Canada. It's very hard to find now. Other bees also, for the people that are doing the bumblebee research, are finding their populations are declining. So it seems to me if we can make use of 30,000 or more acres in the 1.3 million acres of wildlife management, if we could make use of those places to plant that are traditionally planted in corn for deer and pheasants, if we can make use of that place for native pollinators and not use neonicotinoid-treated seeds, it would be a benefit for the bees, a win-win for the bees. I don't understand how that would be negative for farmers since they're not using that corn as a crop. And it would also serve potentially as study areas for future work evaluating the health of wildlife areas for pollinators. So I hope you'll consider this bill carefully as we work to find ways to enhance our landscape for pollinators, because if we can find ways to compromise, it's going to make a really big difference to native pollinators and to the ecological integrity of our wildlife management areas. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions here to start things off? We're going to try and get our testifiers up here, but go ahead. I made the offer.
Go ahead, Chair.
If you'd be so kind to wait, the testifiers are done. I'm sorry, I didn't want to jump out here. So thank you for your testimony. And we have Willa Childress as a testifier. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Greetings, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Willa Childress, and I'm an organizer with Pesticide Action Network North America. PAN works to replace the use of hazardous pesticides with ecologically sound and socially just alternatives. I am here to voice the support of PAN's 2,683 members in the state of Minnesota for House File 721. I'm personally familiar with the impacts of pollinator declines. I grew up on a family farm, and about 10 years ago, my parents noticed that our blueberries, apples, and other crops just weren't producing. A commercial beekeeper a few miles down the road told us that his bees were dying at rates much higher than he had ever seen. For the past few decades, we have all watched the acceleration of this pollinator crisis. The insect apocalypse is now making national headlines, as we've seen in just the past couple of weeks. And last year in Minnesota, beekeepers lost more than half their hives. This huge yearly loss is the second largest ever recorded. Scientists agree, neonicotinoid pesticides, or neonics, are a leading contributor to pollinator declines, and they are intensified by other issues like climate change and habitat loss. Minnesota's wildlife management areas were created in 1951 in another moment of crisis. Decision makers hoped to address the alarming loss of wildlife habitat across our state. After more than 50 years of support by hunters, trappers, wildlife enthusiasts, and legislators, there are over 1 million acres today located across Minnesota. Pollinators need clean food and a safe place to build their homes. And Minnesota's wildlife management areas remain some of the few places left where bees and other pollinators can thrive. The loss of these insects is a big threat to our natural areas. As Margaret mentioned already, about 80% of wild plants need pollinators to reproduce, and wild insects are a critical source of food for both fish and birds. A small portion of wildlife management lands are farmed. About 30 to 40,000 acres of corn are grown as wildlife food plots. Participating farmers harvest a portion of the crop and leave the rest as food for wildlife, particularly for deer and pheasants. Given recent research on the toxicity of neonics to birds as well as insects, this usage is very concerning given the state's pheasant population. Wildlife management areas are already moving in the right direction. It is common practice at the DNR to not use neonics in these state lands. And the DNR is slowly transitioning away from the current food plot makeup, which is monocropped corn, and instead investing in diversified alternatives that provide habitat and food for a broader diversity of wildlife. These practices include cover crops and native plantings, which themselves dramatically reduce the need for any pesticides, including neonics. We are very glad to see that this bill is in line with agency priorities. This is an all-hands-on-deck moment for pollinators. Many sectors of Minnesotans will need to collaborate creatively to solve the pollinator crisis. I hope you agree that House File 721 is a small but practical step in the right direction. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, and I understand there's someone couldn't be here, but there's testimony to be read into the record. The testimony from Mr. Rich Staffen, if I'm saying that name right, and that you we're going to read it into the record. Is that?
Yeah.
If that's okay.
Yes, please. I can read it. All right. Changing hats here a little bit. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Staffen. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Division of the Isaac Walton League. I serve as president of the Duluth chapter of Ikes. The Ikes have 16 chapters and over 1,000 members in Minnesota. We are a natural conservation organization that has been around since the 1920s. Our members are people who hunt and fish and enjoy outdoor activities on our public lands. Our members are also folks who have a strong conservation conscience, so we work and advocate to see that our public lands are protected and managed properly. That is why I'm here today. Our motto is to be defenders of our soil, air, woods, water, and wildlife. I am also a hunter. I have hunted on many different WMAs in Minnesota. Virtually all of my hunting and fishing occurs on public lands and the waters of our state. Much of the food that my family eats comes from these lands. We know that neonicotinoid pesticides pose a significant threat to our insect populations, especially pollinators. Because of their recent widespread use on food crops and their known persistence in the environment, there is also a concern that neonicotinoids could be a danger to mammals, including human health. It just makes common sense to me and the Ikes that these dangerous pesticides should not be used on our wildlife management areas or really on any public lands, and so we strongly support this bill. I am retired now, but for 36 years I worked as a wildlife management manager for the Minnesota DNR. Most of my career was spent working in the Northern Forest at the Cloquet Area Office, but I did spend 2 years at Slayton in the far southwest corner of the state. That was back in the early 1980s, and so I have experience setting up cooperative farming agreements on WMAs. These were mostly small fields of corn which farmers would plant and then in the fall harvest one-third of the crop and for their share and save two-thirds of the corn standing in the fields as food and cover for wintering wildlife, especially deer and pheasants. Nobody was using neonicotinoids in those days, and the corn plots seemed to grow just fine. As a wildlife manager, I would not have any problem requiring farmers to not use seed coated with neonics. In the farmlands of Minnesota, our WMAs are islands of green biodiversity in a sea of corn and soybeans. Only about 2% of the land in that part of the state is public land. The insects living on those islands of public land are a critical food source for pheasant chicks, ducklings, and songbirds. We should be managing those lands in ways that make them as healthy as possible for insects and all the wildlife that lives there. Getting rid of neonicotinoids on our WMAs would be a good for our wildlife populations and would set an example of good land stewardship for other landowners to think about. As a former public land manager, I am somewhat surprised that the DNR has not made this policy change on its own. There seems to be plenty of evidence now of the danger posed by these pesticides, and so this should be an easy decision for them. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on this bill. The Ikes hope that this will become state policy and help us move away from using these bad pesticides.
Thank you for that. And Representative Lee, are there other testifiers that you have?
These are all that I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm going to ask if there are anybody in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Darren McBeth. I'm an attorney lobbyist with Gray Plant Moody Law Firm representing Crop Life America. Crop Life America is a trade association made up of pesticide and chemical companies who work through CLA to ensure that farmers and those who grow our food have technology tools that are safe for the environment and those who use them, and that help protect crops from weeds, disease, fungus, and insect pests. Pesticides, whether chemical, synthetic, or organic, have been part of cropping and food systems and plant production for hundreds of years. The Federal Fungicide, Insecticide, and Rodenticide Act, or FIFRA, was enacted in 1947, reenacted strongly in 1972 to take into account the new Environmental Protection Agency and the testing safety and license to use pesticides resides with EPA under FIFRA. I have three quick points to make today, and then I'll conclude. The first one, back to science and safety. The class of Neonics 7 and all, both in foliar spray form and seed treatments, have been thoroughly tested by the EPA. They're registered and licensed according to the label for a reason. After rigorous review, EPA has granted those licenses to many commercially available products today because seed treatments do not pose a threat to bees or non-target species. Neonics are the most popular insecticide in the world, and in the U.S. used widely on corn, soybeans, cotton, citrus, and many other crops, ornamental uses, residential uses, etc., to protect things that are growing from insects. All neonic insecticides must be used in accordance with their FIFRA label, otherwise it's a violation of law. And when done so, according to the label, EPA has determined pose no or acceptable threats to human health, aquatics, and non-target species. My second point, in terms of the slippery slope we're all in, or the danger of state law picking a class of pesticides or insecticides in this case, to ban, even though just on public lands. Alternative insecticides still exist, are still registered, still have labels, and include chemistries that are typically a lot older than more modern neonics. They are typically more harmful and with a higher toxicity to animals and mammals and birds. These include the pyrethroid classes, organophosphates, carbamates that farmers, even on WMAs, could turn to if they're trying to protect their food plot if neonics are banned, and I, you know, for the intention here, that'd be counterproductive. Lastly, just through the lens of a farmer or a grower, in this case, those planting the food plots under contract with DNR on the WMAs, a quick look at agronomics of putting in those food plots. The irony here is neonics are a helpful tool to controlling insects that damage the food plots and other crops grown for habitat or forage on the WMAs. So this is really a step back for enhanced habitat, for enhanced food plot functionality. And then there of course, is an economic benefit or a yield that would be diminished for the farmer who has that contract to grow these crops that ultimately are harvested, even though a minimal amount of acres, but still reduction of yield is what the net benefit would be. So in conclusion, House File 721 and state-level approaches like it that single out one class of pesticides and propose to ban their use on public lands, first of all, runs afoul of Interstate Commerce Clause, federal EPA jurisdiction regulating these products. Secondly, makes one think Minnesota doesn't or might not support or understand modern agriculture practices and its technology tools. And thirdly, is frankly, as was mentioned, is redundant with DNR current practices of working with contract growers to not use neonic treated seeds, which is the current policy, and other landowners, in this case DNR, working with its tenant or contract farmers to meet environmental or production or whatever goals they may have. And so at an administrative level or at a party-to-party level, rather than state law, is what would be a different preference for what is working now. So respectfully, I urge committee members to reject the approach taken in House File 721. Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. I'm going to ask any other audience members wanting to testify for or against this bill. Okay. So we're gonna move to members' questions. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't have a question at this time, but I do want to point out that there are several members have walked in here, citizens, who are part of the University of Minnesota Extension Red River Valley Emerging Leaders Program, and I just want to recognize them and thank them for being willing to volunteer to be leaders back home. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for paying attention, Representative. We appreciate it.
They weren't all here when you started.
So, questions, Representative Heisman and Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and I'll hit the one first. I just heard the most recent testifier mention something that made me wonder. Representative Lee, I thought I heard the testifier say that the DNR does not use these products on WMAs. What's your knowledge of that?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a member from the DNR who may be able to talk more about that.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Pat Rivers, Deputy Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife, DNR.
I don't know if you the question, maybe restate the question.
I can restate it. I just heard a testifier moments ago mention that we don't use neonics on WMAs. I'm wondering, what is the need for the bill if we don't use them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, we currently by policy do not allow neonicotinoids through our cooperative farming agreements on approximately 15,000 acres of farmland on WMAs that's used for food plots. I would defer to the representative for what the need for the bill is.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and if the representative would explain, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heisman, you know, we all know that even though it's in current policy right now with a change in administration, that policy could change too, and so that's why we want to codify in law so that we are protecting our public lands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll move on to my next question. I don't completely understand. But we actually had a beekeeper here, and I'm a beekeeper as well, and I had a question because this is an issue that every beekeeper in the state of Minnesota deals with, and that's mites. And I was wondering, it sounded like you work really hard to stay away from chemical treatments in other areas, and I wonder if that applied to mites and if you've had any success with that.
You say your name and then proceed.
Margaret Munson from St. Paul. So for me, I have not had to use, for my help of my bees, you're asking me, I have had trouble with varroa mites, not every year. I'm a fairly small beekeeper, so I'm not trying to keep hundreds of hives. And so when I have used treatments, they are natural treatments. The bees produce in their bodies naturally a substance called formic acid, and it is there to defend them somewhat. Well, because their immune systems have been weakened, because there's not enough healthy food for them to feed on, their immune systems are weakened, and then they're exposed to chemicals. And so their ability to resist the pathogens, the parasites, has been limited. So what I have used for my bees is a formic acid preparation that's more concentrated than what they have in their own bodies, and that's been helpful. Has it completely cured everything? No, but what I'm trying to do is treat minimally so that hopefully there will be some natural resistance that the bees will build up.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Without getting too far into the weeds here, explanation that corn is a grass. Corn is self-pollinating, so it pollinates itself. You have male and female parts of the plant, and corn is a self-pollinating plant. And we hear the DNR saying they're kind of going away from corn. So, again, is this necessary? And evidently there is an availability of non-treated seed. That's an issue also with farmers trying to looking at planting corn without treatment. It's difficult to find that seed available. And if the corn planted suffers such a yield drag from not being treated, it may not be economically feasible for the farmer to even bother planting that type of a crop in there. And my one last request, Mr. Chair, it was mentioned in testimony that the number of hives, I believe, in Minnesota declined by 50% last year. I'd like to see if they could provide the committee with the USDA figures on the decline of beehives in Minnesota in 2018, Mr. Chair.
We'll request that information if it can be made available. Please say your name and proceed.
Hi, Willa Childress, Pesticide Action Network. I would be happy to provide that information. I didn't bring that source or that article with me, but I could get that to you at a later date.
Provide it to the chair, and then we'll disseminate that information to everybody.
Yes, sounds good. Regarding neonicotinoid seed treatments, research by the EPA actually found that while seed treatments, while most corn seed is treated prophylactically, and before it even reaches the hands of the farmer, in climates, especially like the upper Midwest, there is research that shows that seed treatments are likely not producing an increase in yield for farmers. And this depends farmer to farmer, but I think it's very important that we set a strong precedent in our public lands. And in fact, this could be a good opportunity to trial the use of non-neonicotinoid treated seeds in these areas. Additionally, untreated corn seed is available, and there are a number of independent suppliers that produce the seed and choose not to treat it beforehand. But it is true that across the board, it's harder to find.
So please follow up with that information, and we'll disseminate that. Representative Anderson, if got what you need for now?
Yeah, I would hope we could get the data from the USDA.
Well, that's what we're going to get that. Did you have something you want to say real quick?
May I address Representative Anderson's point? Margaret Munson again. Yes, corn is self wind pollinated, but when bees are hungry, when they can't get enough diversity in their diet, they'll go for corn pollen. So what we're hoping with this bill is that there would be a much more diverse plants, the opportunity for the bees to get more diverse plants. Just like you and me, you need a diverse diet to be healthy. And bees, if they're forced to have a limited amount of pollen and nectar available from a variety of plants, they're hungry. They will go for corn pollen.
Thank you, Seth.
Did that answer the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of good points here. One, I think I understood that one of the comments was that because of this particular chemical that now the studies are that we've got reduced corn production, and I suggest if we want to answer that, we had to move the bill to the Ag Committee where we can really discuss that. But why don't we go on to something here that I think, and I'll ask the author, I think, what is it you're doing now to increase the diversity these food plots directly, you and the DNR, to support the pollinators. This doesn't say anything about what the previous testifier just mentioned about diversity. I mean, the corn and the beans and that stuff is there primarily for birds and mammals. It was not intended to be there specifically for the pollinators. So I just look, and so why don't we have a whole bunch of separate food plots out there that are diverse, just like the testifier mentioned? I mean, that's what we do in agriculture when you rotate crops. You really can't have good alfalfa, good clover, and those types of things that depend on that. So it just strikes me that this is not only pointless, because, one, the DNR has full authority to regulate exactly what's done on that property, but secondly, it totally misses the point, and I'm speaking specifically to the author. I'll help you with this, but this doesn't do a doggone thing to put new stuff out there for bees, and that's where we need to go here if we're going to walk the walk and not tie this up with a situation. Where is the program here to put – we put those plots out there for the birds, the ones that mostly take home and eat, to sell hunting license, let's be honest, and we put those plots out there for the deer. Where are all the plots, and where is the funding for the plots for the pollinators? This is way off base.
I saw DNR come up, so I'm Representative Lee, if you want to defer to the DNR or however you want to handle that, go ahead and say your name again. And
Mr. Chair, Pat Rivers, Minnesota DNR. We used to do a lot of switchgrass growth and very few species of cover for our birds and for our animals. That has changed. That has evolved over the last 20 years. A good prairie on WMAs now includes forbs, species that bloom throughout the entire year, to your point, Representative Lewick, to provide that pollinator habitat. And it's not uncommon to see 60 different species on our best-managed WMAs. So we're working hard to address those issues, providing habitat not only for pheasants, small mammals, but also for those pollinators, because it's an ecosystem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up, isn't it about time that we shifted the strategy here to do something directly for the pollinators and as we did for pheasants and for deer and those types of things, to provide a suit for, and I'm talking about on a big strategic level here. This, you know, I disagree completely with this, to the author specifically, this accomplishes nothing. They've already got the authority to control what's used there. This doesn't do a doggone thing to move the ball ahead.
I'm going to interject here, because we got a couple bills yet to get back to, but I'm going to offer to you, it sounds like we got bipartisan support to improve these wildlife management areas, and that sounds good to me, Representative Lewick. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lewick, you may not be aware, but in 2013 we passed statute that says that for wildlife management areas we have to have pollinator habitat. So we did it 5 years ago. We said that any land purchased, any land we have, has to have pollinator habitat. We directed the Board of Water and Soil Resources to develop pollinator seed mixes for a cost share on private land. We did extensive work on habitat where we directed the state of Minnesota to do things for pollinators. But the thing we couldn't do because of the intense power of the agricultural chemical industry, is deal with anything with pesticides. And so what Representative Lee has here is saying, just on 30,000 acres, could we have 30,000 acres of public land that we don't spray? And as a state, we have the choice on what we choose to buy. The interstate commerce argument was patently ridiculous on its face. We have the choice on what we can buy. And so we provide the habitat. We spend tons of money. When we do the restorations, when we do the enhancements, they have to have pollinator habitat, not just on wildlife management areas. But if we spend all that money and then the pollinators get sprayed and they die because of the chemicals or because of the seed treatment, which we had testimony in either this or the other committee, that we're spending money on trying to reintroduce endangered species, and they're getting contact with chemicals. So there's no naturally occurring neonicotinoid. It didn't exist 25 years ago. And to assert the right to spray it everywhere on our public lands, we can do things differently. We don't have to just plant corn. We can plant sorghum. We can plant oats. We can plant a variety of food plots. Diversity is what makes the difference for food plots, and diversity is what makes the difference in our habitat. And we've done that by statute. Everything we do has to have the pollinator habitat. Everything, we've spent buku money on research. We developed a bee lab that's the best in the country. They're researching mites, Representative Heinzman. Pesticides, parasites, poor nutrition, poor habitat. Minnesota has dealt with 3 out of 4. Pesticides, a pesticide discussion is always off limits at the Minnesota legislature, where we cannot take action because of the power of the lobby. So I applaud you, Representative Lee, for putting and trying to do a little bit on our public lands, a little bit to make a difference for those little wildlife, not just the wildlife we shoot, but the wildlife that makes the ecological chain of life work.
Representative,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's one element I agree there with, and that's the diversity. And again, and this is to the DNR. We're thrown around. Everybody's thrown around a lot of acreages and all kinds of stuff. Let's see it. Let's see very specifically. I mean, I can only relate to one that's in my immediate area, but I don't see anything special going on there at the Wealthwood Wildlife Management Area that's any other unique. And as far as I know, they are not using coated seeds there. But you made a great case that we might have turned the corner and we're going to do a lot of diversity, but I haven't seen any testimony from the DNR on the specifics. We've heard a lot of things about separate wildlife management areas. And, again, that this is a place looking for something to do. You already have authority to absolutely control what's done there. So let's walk the walk on what you've actually done.
I need to say something because we got two more bills, and we've got some folks from out of state that came to testify, and we want to respect that they traveled away. A couple people on the list yet here. I'm going to call everybody's name. Representative Wagenius, please, as succinct as you can, please.
Oh, thank you, Representative Hansen, for reviewing the history. It's very important for people to understand. The testifier from Crop Life America made the rather blanket statement that neonics are safe. Yet we know, and there's really good science talking about not just bees, which has been the discussion, but birds, including pheasants. And I would hope that, since we don't want to take a lot of time right now, Representative Lee, I would hope your testifiers would bring us some of the data related to birds. And since a pheasant is a bird and a pheasant eats corn, and a pheasant will eat corn seeds with neonics on it because it doesn't know the difference, we need to be concerned about the decline in the pheasant population. So I would just appreciate it if your testifiers would help us out at a later time, because we're short on time, and I understand that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief, too. So first, I want to thank you, Representative Lee. I think by putting this in statute, we are stating that going forward that there will be demand for the seed, so that then there's reason for the seed producers to produce the seeds that we need, because then we will know going forward years into the future that that is the thing that the DNR will be choosing to do, because the statute will be telling them to do that. And second, I just wanted to point out we're in the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Committee, and I think This bill doesn't need to go to the Ag Committee. I think it's kind of telling that the word insecticide is in this bill, and we automatically, you know, think that it needs to go to an Ag Committee. So I thank you for your work. It's a simple bill, but that doesn't mean it's not going to do some good in our wildlife management areas and protecting those public spaces. So thank you.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we were talking about mites a few minutes ago, Representative Hansen, and I agree with Representative Penis. It was a nice speech. Mites are a big problem across the state. I'm glad that we're working on that problem, but what the general public needs to know is that without the processes, the chemicals that are available to beekeepers across the state, it would be virtually impossible to carry bees through the winter. In a lot of cases, bees are being transported to other parts of the country. There's a lot of things that we need to better understand about bees. And I'm glad that the testifier was able to mention a few of the natural products that are available. But in most cases, and in my own experience, I've failed using natural products. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on this. And I understand Representative Lee's interest in this issue, and Representative Hansen's as well, and Wagenius as well. We've heard these conversations. We've had lots of conversations about neonics. But as we heard from the DNR, they do not use these chemicals. And if we codified every policy at DNR into law, we'd literally spend the next, 4 months working on codifying DNR policy, because there's one after another after another. So we're just trying to use our time efficiently, and I don't think this we're not trying to rewrite everything that DNR does in terms of their policy going forward. I don't think that's productive.
Representative Anderson, come back to you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I think the frustration here among, I'm an ag guy, is that this is something the DNR does already. So we're not reinventing the wheel here. Not a lot is going to change because this becomes part of statute. Will the next governor or the new governor change this policy? I really doubt it. And, you know, there's concern about, you know, what's next. And being this really wouldn't affect what is going on now with the DNR, and they can have their policies be pretty rock solid. It's just the frustration of will this really make any changes? And then speaking on the ag side, what may be next?
Representative Fabian.
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, there's been a lot of references made here today about agriculture and farming and farmers and so forth, and I would disagree with Representative Becker-Finn that I think that this bill should go to the Ag Committee. That being said, we also heard testimony from or comments from Representative Wagenius about the impact on pheasants with neonics. I would ask one of two things of you, Mr. Chair, that you consider changing your motion to either send this bill to the Ag Committee or to just lay it on the table and we can pick it up at another time. Thank you.
Appreciate your word. I'm going to ask for any final comments from the author on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to bring it back to that. This bill is to protect our public lands and to really, you know, see how can we protect our pollinators. And that's, the testifier has mentioned before, that it's so crucial to our food system, you know, through the different plants. And then we have heard from the testifiers through the wildlife that we have here in the state of Minnesota. And, you know, I appreciate the comments that were made from members of the committee too. And, you know, like I would say, like all of us, our door is always open if you want to pursue a different, you know, bill idea to address some of the concerns that were brought forth. I'm open to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 721 be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevailed. I would now like to bring up, bring back House File 680, Representative Tabke. There's been some discussions on how to proceed here, and I think there's a good agreement. Representative Becker-Finn has been involved in that. So, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the public's knowledge, those of us who are interested in this bill, both sides of the table have discussed it, went out in the hallway and did our work quickly. So the move would be, so my motion would be to move to amend House File 680 as currently amended as follows. So line 4.1, we would remove the sentence that starts with if the deer or bear is located alive, and then renumber that section accordingly. And then in our discussions, our research also brought to our attention a technical amendment that we could also take care of right now, which is on line 1.18. I would further move to remove the words person using a and add the word used after the word dog. So essentially, what's the protections of that section are for the dog and not the dog handler, so just clarifying that that's what we're doing in that section.
Okay, you've heard the proposed amendments. Representative Tapke, any comments here?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for everyone for working and for bringing this up, especially Representative Fabian. This makes it a, after talking with everyone, it makes it a better bill, and looking forward to hopefully passing this out of committee today.
Okay. Sounds good. Any? I don't. Not seeing anybody raising their hand. I think we got the agreement that we were looking for here. I'll renew my motion to. I'm sorry. Yep. Gonna back up.
Renew my motion.
And we need the amendments. We got to approve the amendments. Everybody clear on the amendments? I know they're. Okay. All right. All in favor of the amendments that Representative Becker Finn presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendments are adopted. So, now, we renew the motion that House File 680 be, as amended, be moved to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Tapke. Okay, so we've got a few minutes here, Representative Anderson, and we do have room 5 we can move to as need be. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Please proceed. We do have, I'm advised we likely have this room till about noon, so
okay.
Depending on how many questions we get here, we'll all be pretty hungry by that time. So please proceed, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I believe you or somebody has to move the bill. I don't have the script
sorry.
In front of me.
I'm sorry. I'll move that House File 200 be in front of us, and where are we? Okay, and this is being laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope this bill can kind of bring us all back together again here today. It deals with the buffer compensation, and since the buffer bill was passed back in 2015, it has struck me that when you make a program mandatory, you make it a lot more complicated. You add in enforcement, and we've made some changes to try to make the bill better in the ensuing years, but the one thing we really haven't addressed, in my opinion, is that of compensation. And when the state is requiring landowners, farmers, to give up productive, tillable farmland and to put in a buffer strip, I think that there is some movement that the state should help pay for that, and the farmer shouldn't have to shoulder that loss of a potential income by putting in a buffer on productive farmland. And Mr. Chair, this bill is rather prescriptive, trying to deal with all the aspects of buffers that were put in years ago and didn't get payment. I understand that, but I had to start someplace and end someplace, and So this bill is prescriptive in that it only pertains to buffers installed along public waters of that DNR map that was used to guide Bowser in buffers being put on public land. And, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment, that simply makes a change in the year, which expands by 1 year the eligibility for buffers to be eligible for this payment. It's on page 2, line 11, and page 2, line 28, that simply moves the end date from 2018 to 2019. The latest buffer map that I saw showed that we were 99% complete in terms of buffer installation, but that 1% that's remaining would then be eligible, and may encourage them to get their buffers installed yet this year and be eligible for this payment. I had a bill last year that was simply a tax credit. That bill is also alive this year. But what this bill does, and again, it's prescriptive to land that's put aside for public water buffers, it would pay the average county rental rate per year that land is in the buffer. So the payment would be substantially larger than the $50 per acre payment, which to me, it's only fair that you would pay the farmer or landowner the approximate value of the land that he is putting aside in a buffer strip.
I thought I heard you move the A1 amendment.
I'd like to move that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I just wanted to take care of that while we've got put it in front of us here and take care of that. And any questions on the A1? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Please proceed.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So again, the eligible dates to be eligible here are 2015, when the original buffer law was passed, and it now would extend it through the year 2019 to be eligible to take part in this program. It pertains to a two-way tillable farmland, and the farmer would in essence certify his own acreage. He would get a form for the Department of Revenue, and he would have to determine the number of acres to the nearest acre, whole acre. That would have to be signed off by the local SWCD, and then that would be submitted for his payment to the state of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, that's pretty basic what the bill does. And I would stand for questions from members.
Representative Guinness.
Representative Anderson, you're trying to set a precedent that I see spilling over into other areas. So I am thinking about, I live in the city of Minneapolis, and our city will regularly tell a building owner who wants to build a 40-story building, no, it can only be 30 stories. Or a building that wants to be 8 stories, no, you can only be 6 stories, taking away potential income. Similarly, the city will say, a builder will want to build to the lot line, and the city will say, no, you can't build to the lot line. Again, taking away potential income. If you set this precedent, do you expect that, I mean, I would expect, I will, that other people will say, now I have to be reimbursed because I can't exercise every right I thought I would like to have in having this piece of property as an income-producing piece of property. How do you see, is that a good precedent to step for the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, you raise a valid point, and what you're talking about is a planning or zoning instance where government is saying you cannot do this. What the buffer law does, it says you must do this. And
if this bill doesn't pass, and I can't answer the question because I'm not a court, but I think if we don't provide some type of compensation to farmers or landowners who have land put into buffer strips, this will be challenged in court. Now, that's my opinion. Constitution says just compensation for the taking of public land, of private land. And this is one thing we haven't addressed yet with the buffer law. And I think if we don't look at this aspect of compensation, it will get challenged in court.
Well, similarly, Representative Anderson, if you were to set this precedent, which I hope you don't, a building owner who is told you must not build higher than and loses two stories or 40 stories or whatever and loses a lot of income because of that, that could be called a taking, just as you are arguing. I think the courts have been very clear that this is not a taking and that the argument that you are making that the courts would go along with you is not a good one.
Mr. Chair, I respectfully disagree. And I don't have any buffers on my farm, so this doesn't affect me individually, but if I'm told by my local SWCD that I have to give up 9 acres of productive farmland and put in grass strips, I would think I should be compensated. If this is good for the state, and we all hope it is, then I think the state should step up to the plate and help compensate landowners who lose potential income. A big one of
those. Hang on here. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, I'm just wondering what I don't see a fiscal note. I'm just wondering what the cost of this is going to be.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative. We don't know yet. The fiscal note has been ordered, and the numbers on page 5 are for the administration of the program. That is not the cost. It's going to be expensive, and the biggest unknown right now is the number of acres that would be eligible for the program. Again, it's fairly prescriptive. It would involve acres only in public water buffer areas, not the public ditches. But the fiscal note is on the way, and it was going to be here in time for a fiscal committee meeting whenever that would come, is what I was told yesterday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just give me, like, an idea? You say expensive, like the scale, some concept, just because, you know, I don't have even a vague idea.
That's a good question. And, again, it depends on the number of acres because that determines half the equation here as far as payments. I believe the governor in his announcement yesterday proposed the $50 an acre payment for a tax credit. As I recall, that cost was something in the neighborhood of $15 million. But again, what acres were eligible for that, that's the unknown here.
Okay, so...
Representative Gomez.
Madam Chair, thank you. I mean, I know this is a policy committee, not a finance committee, but not knowing that at all makes it really difficult to think about supporting this at this time. I'm also interested in, you know, anytime we're talking about this kind of compensation, I think about the difference in the impacts of sort of large versus smaller operations and you know, what it means for a really big, large kind of highly profitable operation versus something that's really small. And so I'm wondering if there's any thought about imposing any income sensitivity or any kind of progressivity into this scheme, or if it's just like straight up, no matter who you are, you're getting the same amount.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This would not be that descriptive. It's complicated enough trying to come up with acreages and payments and what's eligible without putting in some income eligibility. And again, if you lose productive acres, you should be compensated. In my opinion, you should be compensated for it. So it, this does not have any income stipulations to it.
Representative Gomez?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. I guess, yeah, again, just for me, absent that, it's difficult to think about supporting this just because I am sensitive to how, you know, if, for example, just like thinking about what, you know, what percentage of somebody's holding is being, it has to be converted to a riparian buffer, for example, would be a way of thinking about kind of further protecting those smaller operations. So it doesn't necessarily have to be about income, but for me, it's like I would want to any policy that was you know, compensating, using public dollars to compensate business owners, I would want some sensitivity about the size of the operation. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, being mindful of time, I do want to take a pause on questions to see if there's anyone, particularly if there's anyone who has traveled to our committee to come testify on this. Now would be the time to come forward. Please state your name for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Leslie Everett. I live in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. I'm a recently retired agronomist and also a farm owner. And I was also on the drainage work group, the state drainage work group, which you're probably aware of, for several years. The substance of this bill came before the drainage work group, and we did not reach consensus on it. I found the bill to not be advisable, and for the following reasons. As you probably know, the buffer requirement was in shoreland rules for many years. It was also in the, it's also been in the street, the public drainage bill, 103E statute. So the requirement's been there for many years. Some counties, some drainage authorities, some counties implemented it, others didn't. So there are farmers out there who have had those buffers in place for many years. They're not covered under this bill. Secondly, there was no absolute requirement to have the buffer. In the buffer law, there is a provision for to substitute alternative conservation practices. So you could do something like strip tillage or some other productive, should we say crop productive practice, not have to put in a buffer. It just had to meet the requirements that were put out there by Bowser and the SWCDs. Farmers were also given the ability to have variable width buffers to meet the requirement. So for those reasons, I don't see this as a good use of the general fund money at this time. Like I said, I have a farm. We have buffers. I'm not compensated for it. We just expect that. And part of the reason for having the buffers is to stabilize the ditch banks, and just the ditch banks by dewatering the ditch banks. One of the biggest sources, or the biggest source in the Minnesota River Basin of sediment, is actually stream bank bluff and ravine erosion. I was part of the team that wrote a book on that. And stabilizing those stream banks, you need to have a permanent vegetation there, not just four months out of the year. That costs us all if it's not there. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any additional testifiers from the audience? If there's anyone else, since we're short on time, if you could go ahead and come up to the front so that we can move quickly to the next testifier. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Dan Larson, Minnesota Rural Counties here today to testify in support of House File 200 as an important and necessary component to closing the loop on buffer implementation. Though we understand this is a complicated issue, we want to recognize Representative Anderson's effort in taking this on. And again, this is the last piece for final buffer implementation, and extremely important. The issue of compensating landowners for land taken out of production from a state mandate may be complicated in St. Paul, but in greater Minnesota, it's not complicated at all. A landowner that's in this day and age, the ag economy is not good. So buffers taken out of production means tillable lands that, of course, are going to affect the bottom line. So I want to, again, thank Representative Anderson. Again, it's a key and critical component that must be implemented to relieve landowners for compliance with this state-mandated program.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, we have numerous members on the list to speak on both sides of the aisle. However, I am aware of the time and we have to get out of this room. And my understanding, Representative Anderson, is you might have a different version of this bill being introduced, or there might be some other buffer bills coming forward in the coming days, if you could speak to that.
Madam Chair, this is the only bill I have this year pertaining to this. You know, I could just comment on the previous testifier. If farmers have used strip till or that type of thing, that's fine. They haven't lost tillable ground if they strip till. That's just a method of tillage. So they wouldn't be paid under this if they didn't actually lose productive land. So that, to me, is a non-issue. If you're doing a strip tillage or some kind of variable tillage, if you don't lose land, tillable land, you wouldn't be compensated under this program.
Okay, so my understanding is there are other bills. Maybe it isn't your bill, Representative Anderson, but this discussion of buffers will, I think, best be continued on a different day when we have those other bills in front of us. As we have to be out of this room. So I will renew Chair Purcell's motion to lay your bill on the table as amended, and we'll come back to it at another time.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, the bill is laid over. And with that, we are adjourned.